It is Thursday, April 7th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Seder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Luke Savage, writer for Jacobin Magazine and author of The Dead Center, Reflections on Liberalism and Democracy After the End of History. And later in the program, Rana Abdelhamid, congressional candidate running in New York's 12th district. Meanwhile, the Senate is expected to confirm Ketanji Brown Jackson to the Supreme Court today, making her the first black woman to sit on the court in history. Despite very appropriate cynicism about the court's function, cynicism I share, this is a historic day. It really is. More civilians are fleeing Ukraine as Russian forces move out of the Kyiv suburbs and begin to coalesce in the east. Over 11 million Ukrainians have fled their homes since the start of the invasion. And while the EU considers banning Russian coal, and the U.S. has announced additional sanctions against Russian banks and Putin's daughters, specifically, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has gone a different direction. He will pay for Russian gas in rubles, breaking with the other European Union countries. Right-wing authoritarians have to stick together, right? The Omicron sub-variant BA2 is on the rise in the Northeast, specifically here in New York City, weeks after the city lifted many of its masking and vaccine requirements. For now, infections are largely being seen in the under 35 population, but it could be disastrous if it spreads to the elderly. This comes as researchers are meeting with the FDA to explore a modified COVID vaccine for the fall. The cost of distribution of a revamped COVID vaccine will cost billions, and Congress has yet to approve Biden's requested COVID relief money because he decided to lift Title 42. So Republicans are blocking it. And lastly, the House has voted to hold Peter Navarro and Dan Scavino in contempt after refusing to comply with the January 6th probe. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to Thursday. I mean, it's my favorite day of the week for the show. That's not true.
Slam on Sam.
That's not true.
Right off the bat.
I have to carry more of the weight, so I have to be a bit more on point on these days. So it's probably actually not my favorite day of the week. I'd have to think about it. Monday.
It works great, Jack.
Oh, come on, Jack. I would say maybe casual Friday, but that Majority Report Thursdays is definitely up there. Definitely up there. Because yep. I get to freewheel it and freeball it. I'm freeballing it by saying freeballing it. Anyway. Yes, today the Senate is going to vote to confirm Ketanji Brown Jackson. As we've mentioned on the show before, there are three Republicans who have joined to vote yes: Mitt Romney, Lisa Murkowski, and Susan Collins. They did this for their own personal branding and reputation and to disarm Democrats from using their typical obstructionist behavior against them and treating the Republican Party as an extremist monolith, which is what we should be doing. So let's be real about that. No praise for Murkowski. No praise for Collins. No praise for Romney. This is a part of a way to make sure that the Democrats aren't able to attack Republicans adequately. Even though, you know, even if they all voted against her, the Democrats still wouldn't be able to find a way to attack Republicans.
It gives people like Stephen Crowder and Ben Shapiro like a day to pretend like they're not just in lockstep with GOP incentives. Like Stephen Crowder had a show. Crowder, what a piece of, and then SH'T, Mitt Romney. And that was his show for that day.
Yeah, so. Right. So it's That's they're trying to have the flip side of like when we have shows just crapping all over Joe Manchin, for example.
Right.
They get to pretend like, you
except
know,
they love Joe Manchin.
Right. But for us, it's like that's what they're treating it as, their flip right. side. They're, yeah, yeah. you know, the traitor to the cause, et cetera, even though no matter what the Republicans did in this case, she was going to get confirmed. So it's really just an aesthetic argument, or I guess it's performative.
Right. And in this, in similar ways to like the way Democrats, even though they knew they weren't going to try to fully stop certain Supreme Court justices from getting approved under the Trump administration, but you need to do something that shows a fight. So
right.
That's all I'll say on that.
I mean, Dianne Feinstein missed that memo, but regardless, she misses a lot of memos.
She gets some of them and then misses them later.
Yeah, but she's missing them all in her heart and in her mind. Every memo's missed to Dianne. But let's turn to this this Biden clip here. So Biden spoke to union members yesterday. I believe this is the North America Building Trades Union here. And he addressed the Amazon unionization effort and the successful vote, although there's still a ways to go, in Staten Island. And he made a pretty broad pronouncement and said, watch out, Amazon, essentially. Let's watch.
That's what unions are about, in my view, about providing dignity and respect for people who bust their neck. That's why I created the White House Task Force on Worker Organization Empowerment, to make sure the choice to join a union belongs to workers alone. And by the way, Amazon, here we come. Watch. Watch.
Like, I mean, that's Biden at his best, honestly.
And listen to the roar of that audience. I mean, obviously, the National Building Trades Union's going to be excited about stuff like that. But that is stuff that is hard for politicians to just walk away from. And Democrats, like, love to walk away from this stuff, but
walk
if there's
away,
enough of
saying?
That energy, exactly, like that, it's impossible, and they get caught up in the moment. And you know, we should applaud Joe Biden. And if he really wants to help out Amazon workers, he can do what Chris Small said, which is pass the PRO Act.
Right. Well, and then so those are the caveats there, right? He made very little effort to pressure Manchin. I mean, it's not just Manchin and Sinema. It's going to be like guys like Mark Warner. Even maybe more vociferously, who are opposed to the PRO Act.
But your senators, Joe.
Yeah, he did not pressure them adequately. He did not pressure those same senators adequately on Build Back Better, which would have included some of the PRO Act elements. So he failed in that regard. But that doesn't mean that this doesn't have value. And I think it's stark to compare Jay Carney, former Obama press secretary, is one of the top executives at Amazon right now. By the way, his cover photo on Twitter is of him hugging Biden. It's like not subtle at all. And he hasn't tweeted since the Amazon union vote that sided in favor of the union. He's down bad.
I mean, a lot of just horrible, horrible people, alumni of the Obama administration. And better keep those guys quiet.
It shows progress. And it also shines light on the strength of Biden's, which was that, you know, he always did fashion himself as like a pro-union guy, maybe more an aesthetic than an actual practice. But again, I want to reiterate that this does have value. And I know it's not tangible, and I know it's not the PRO Act. But like, there was rumblings that Biden had resentment towards kind of the Harvard intelligentsia elites that Obama had stacked his administration with. And he wants to be more of the, you know, regular Joe, the guy that takes the train, the guy that supports unions. And so when he's off the cuff like this, being pro-union, I think that as a we have to mark that as progress, especially in comparison to what the Obama administration fashioned themselves as. Did Obama say the word worker once? I mean, I'm sure he did, but it was not an emphasis.
Yeah, and it blows out future and even past excuses that politicians gave for not showing up for workers. So and putting them, you know, rhetorically delivering for them at least. And there's no excuses not to stay silent during fights like this.
Right. So I was happy to see that. But some people were not happy to see that. Let's first start with Chuck Todd, who was, I believe, on MSNBC, or was it NBC? You guys have it? Yeah, they were airing this speech, and when Biden began to talk about workers and unions, Chuck Todd was like, this is not interesting. This is not about Ukraine, so thing doesn't go boom, and I don't care.
I want to talk about what I'm here today to talk about. You women are men in the American union movement. Remember.
Hey, pause it for a sec. Look at the chyrons beneath this. It's about Kyiv, and this war could continue for a long time. He is speaking
against the war against the capitalists by the laborers.
Yeah, what? Maybe it's accurate. You're right. You're right. Except it'll be proved. It's because he briefly talks about Ukraine here, and that's clearly the only thing that MSNBC cares about. Keep going.
Remember, you know, when the Fair Labor Standards
Act. We wanted to bring you the top of those remarks on Chuck Todd here at Meet the Press Daily. We wanted to bring you the top of those remarks. We knew they were going to be about the latest decision by the U.S. government and Biden administration to announce some new sanctions on Russia. The rest of his speech, it is a union event. It is obviously not expected to be about Russian sanction. Bring you any news. If it happens, you can go find the speech online if you would like. The new sanctions, in coordination with the G7 and EU, are part of the Biden administration's.
Is that not unbelievable? Like,
it's like he's apologizing to the executives. Like, why are we running Joe Biden at a union event?
Yes.
It's like, well, he was doing something about Ukraine, guys. Please
right.
don't. Yeah.
Right. Please. I mean, then we'll get back to the normal coverage of, and again, it's worthwhile, of course, to cover Ukraine. But that's, I mean, again, I will bring up my infamous laundry room, which always has CNN on. That's all is being discussed. That's it. And if there's anything that challenges capitalists, if there's anything that challenges capital, and Biden is like addressing this wide unionization effort throughout the country where workers are understanding the value of their labor, that's not sexy. That's actually very scary for the MSNBC executive. So let's cut away. But Psaki was also feeling the heat here too, because as I mentioned earlier, Biden is still cozy with some of the wants to maintain the relationships with some of these people in the Biden or the Obama administration, his former colleagues in that way. And Jay Carney, top executive there, Amazon and big tech during the Democratic primary also was financially much more behind Biden than any of the other candidates. So here's Jen Psaki trying to walk back one of the very good Biden improv statements, but she's got to bring up the rear guard for industry here.
Can I ask, President Biden today told union members, Amazon, here we come. Was he endorsing the efforts of workers to unionize Amazon facilities?
What he was not doing is sending a message that he or the U.S. government would be directly involved in any of these efforts or take any direct action. What he was conveying is that is his longtime support for collective bargaining, for the rights of workers to organize, and their decision to do exactly that in this case, something that he has long supported broadly over the course of his career.
Which, you know, if she wasn't trying to be like, we're not targeting Amazon specifically, that wouldn't be contradictory to what he said, because when he said Amazon, here we come, he's talking about unionization. He does support if he supports collective bargaining, he supports it in Amazon's case specifically. And it's the most high profile one that's out there right now. But at the same time, she's got to just calm the waters a bit. And so the Amazon doesn't give Biden the stern phone call.
Yeah, this is what it looks like to ride, try to ride two horses at once and see if the Democratic Party can actually do it. Probably not.
Right. But
you got to pick a side. You got to ultimately, and Joe Biden picked a side. And it is like classic Joe, right? I remember the "this is a big fucking deal" thing when he said it was said about healthcare, and like that was cool. But the thing that was cool about that wasn't like Obamacare. It was like that the Democrats for once were proud of delivering sort of public goods to people, and it turned out to be an aberration, sort of. But I'm very happy Joe did that, and I hope Uncle Joe does more of that stuff.
Yes. Again, and then just to wrap this up, his off the cuff stuff is mostly bad, right? He's during the primary yelling at immigration activists for demanding more from him, for example. But there is this one instinct of his that's been right for a while, and it's to support, at least rhetorically, workers here. So again, more of this, and
pass the PRO Act.
Yeah, pass the PRO Act. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will be joined by Luke Savage, writer at Jacobin and author of the new book, which I have right here, The Dead Center: Reflections on Liberalism and Democracy After the End of History. Be right back. We are back, and we are joined by friend of the show, Luke Savage, writer for Jacobin Magazine and author of The Dead Center: Reflections on Liberalism and Democracy After the End of History. Luke, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here.
Good to see you, Emma. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, good to see you too. So when does the book come out? Because I've gotten a special sneak peek, but I want the general public to know when they can finally get your book.
That's a good question. I wish I had a real answer, more precise than soon, I hope, but
okay.
It's still available for pre-order, and if you pre-order, you'll get 15% off. Once I know, I'll announce on Twitter, and hopefully soon. April or May, I
think.
I
didn't mean to put you on the spot. I just want, so everybody just pre-order it. That's probably the safest bet in this situation. But anyway, thanks so much for being here. I've always loved your writing, and what's great about your book is that it's just a collection of your writing and some of your essays and reflections on politics from when you were born, you say in 1989, which is the, you said that, right? That's the right date? Yeah. That's the perfect date to demarcate, that period of time when we're talking about the end of history and then moving forward. The Obama election, which was this formative experience for a lot of people, myself included. I was born in 94, so big deal. But you voted in the Obama election, right?
Well, I'm not actually eligible to vote in American elections because I'm not an American citizen. But what I can tell you is, I was in my first year of university at the time. And this was at the University of Toronto. And so I wasn't even in the United States. And there was absolute euphoria up here. There were people, I was watching it in my dorm's common room, and people had kind of tears streaming down their faces. And then everybody sort of spontaneously streamed out into the quad and, were hugging and kind of punching the air and stuff like that. So, I bring it up, just because it really gives a sense of how significant that was to so many people. you know, especially given that, you know, this wasn't Berkeley, this wasn't NYU, this was a campus in Canada. I mean, that's how kind of far the Obama euphoria spread.
That was a dumb question because you do have this whole chapter on on Canada and I want to dive into that as well. But I guess we can talk there in terms of, or start there with the concept of the end of history and then move into the Obama election. For people who might not know, what is that concept and why did you make it one of the central points of your book?
Sure. Okay. I mean, so the end of history is the title or part of a title of a book by Francis Fukuyama. And it kind of that book famously posited, came out in the '90s, famously posited liberalism, kind of liberal democratic institutions as the sort of end point of human history. So, you know, it's to be very general about it, the suggestion was that we've arrived at this situation where most societies either are or contend to be or are moving towards, you know, liberal democratic institutions, you know, a kind of market economy, that sort of thing. And it's significant for a few reasons. I mean, I think, you know, every era in some way thinks it's special, right? Every era has a sense of its own exceptionalism. I think the era in which both you and I are born was exceptional in its exceptionalism, if I can put it that way. I mean, it's quite a thing to for there to be a pervasive sense, right? This wasn't just in the book. This was, you know, Fukuyama was articulating something that was really in the air at the time. It was really informing politics, particularly in the Anglo-American world, but also beyond, this belief that, you know, really there were no alternatives to this, you know, sort of taking up, channeling Margaret Thatcher's famous phrase, right? There is no alternative. From now on, politics is going to be contested within this much narrower set of parameters than it had been in the 20th century, where, of course, you know, you had liberalism, but you also had all of these challenges to liberalism, obviously the communist challenge, the fascist challenge as well. And I think also it's important to add the social democratic challenge as well, which you saw in European countries and elsewhere. So that's a very truncated kind of answer to your question. But I think all of this is significant because even today, there really is still a belief that a lot of people have that there really isn't an alternative that is possible or can really even be imagined to the present that we currently live in. And I think that's still a very significant influence, the kind of an ambient influence that exerts on our politics and on really all of our social and cultural discourse as well.
So, yeah, what's your sense of how that, I mean, it's the myth that capitalism has won forever and it's going to be naturalized as the only system, and also, you know, neoliberal politics, there's really very little alternatives to it. Social democracies, that's reserved for tiny countries, maybe in Northern Europe, but we're not going to promote those policies among the broader population in bigger capitalist countries like the U.S. Like, how did an entire generation of politicians all align along that same religious belief in those ideas? Because that's a huge force of groupthink that it's hard to even fathom how, like, you know, it just became so unchallengeable in such a short period of time.
Yeah, that's true. And I mean, if you go back 30 years before the so-called end of history, I mean, a lot of people felt the same thing, including many conservatives, by the way, I think had the same sense of kind of Keynesian social democracy and the welfare state that emerged in Europe and elsewhere after the Second World War. People felt that that was an impregnable consensus and that really you could only make kind of tweaks within it. You could have a sort of conservative version of it, or you could have a version that maybe trended towards some kind of socialism, but there was no, there was nothing that could, you know, no horizon that could be really seen beyond it. What happened in the 90s, I think, is, I mean, it's complicated because, I mean, you use the word religious, and I think that's the right word. There's a kind of really a secular theology almost that's developed in the 1990s around liberal democratic capitalism. And the story of how that comes about, I think, is complicated. I mean, there's, in kind of the macro sense, you have the you know, obvious seismic event of the fall of the Soviet Union and also preceding that, really the the clear failure and dysfunction of what the Soviet model had become to deliver anything. I mean, the kind of final years of the Soviet Union especially are just characterized by such dysfunction and also, decrepit leadership that's unable to hang on to power and all that kind of thing. So that's one thing. I think another factor, and this can't really be overlooked either, although it's a more boring answer in some ways, is in the countries where neoliberalism is most potent and where it develops, I think, most strongly, first among conservatives, but then also is taken up by liberals in some cases in an even more fanatical way. So I'm thinking about Britain and America especially. There's a specific context, which is that in the United States, the Liberal Party and kind of the New Deal consensus, that being the Democrats, and then in Britain, the Labour Party, really suffered defeats throughout the 1980s, unlike anything that they'd suffered before. I mean, there are these big Reagan landslides, and in the UK, the Labour Party loses four general elections between 1979 and 1992. And at the same time, the institutions that had kind of buttressed, the post-war settlement in these countries, so big working class institutions, trade unions built at least partly around strong manufacturing, that kind of thing, those institutions are completely battered. So there's no longer kind of the popular and institutional foundation that there had been before. And so there's a complicated interplay of kind of ideas and material factors here. But by the time you get to the 1990s, I mean, I think I'll just turn to the British example because I don't want to be too exhaustive here. By the time you get to Tony Blair in 97, there's really nothing left in Labour's program that has anything to do with social democracy, really. They're proudly boasting about how they're going to spend the exact same amount as the Tories. But people were so fed up with 18 years of conservative rule and so kind of on the hunt for some kind of novelty. Blair was able to present himself as this kind of transformational leader. And in doing so, he was able to kind of channel a lot of the kind of zeitgeist in the air about the end of history that we've been talking about. So it's a big question, but I guess that's a sketch of an answer.
Right. And I think, I've seen people compare, Clinton and Blair a bit more, but to the presentation of a transformational figure but at the same time only upholding the same structures is a lot more akin to Obama in a sense, right? Because, I was born in 94. It's hard for me to say, but the transformational nature of Obama's presidency or his candidacy, I think, was more at the forefront, and the results are quite similar.
Absolutely. I mean, so I think it's important to distinguish between the period we just talked about and kind of the period that came after it with Obama, because of course and obviously other figures elsewhere as well, because the kind of first wave of the end of history, if you want, there's actually a lot of enthusiasm around this stuff. The figures like Blair, I think, and Clinton as well, I mean, they were quite genuine ideologues. I mean, they really believed in this stuff. It had a certain intellectual credibility, liberal democratic capitalism at the time. There was a lot of triumphalism about kind of what it was going to yield and what a sort of US-led global order was going to yield in terms of the spread of democracy and things like that. I think by the time you get to 2008, when Obama's elected, that's much less credible as a rendering, right, of things, right? You've had 9/11,
war, right? And like, I mean, yeah, that's a quite short, that's an 18 year near or 20 year shelf life for the status of the end quo of the end of history.
That's absolutely
not a long end.
That's right. And I mean, famously, one of my favorite kind of slogans to come out of Britain in this period was that, New Labour said they were going to end boom and bust. Well, the economic part of this settlement, I mean, nail in the coffin for it in many ways, at least in terms of its credibility, was the financial crash, which, of course, preceded Obama's rise as well. I mean, so when you get to Obama, Obama, I think he's a really important figure to understand. And I hope, in the near future to be able to say a lot more about him. I still think he is in some ways the most important figure to understanding kind of the centrist liberal project and where it's going to continue to try to go moving forward. Because as you said, he was somebody who was, uniquely gifted at presenting a kind of small C conservative view of the world, a sort of managerial and non-transformative and actually anti-transformative view of the world, but presenting it with kind of such style and vigor and dynamism and with such kind of a remarkable gift to weave together political narratives that huge numbers of people of different political persuasions found compelling. He's really the virtuoso of that style, which is now, has since become kind of the house style of liberals and of American liberals in particular. The longest section of the book, the longest essay in the book is the essay on Obama. And then the longest section in the book consists of essays dealing with various kind of liberal figures, many of whom were candidates in the 2020 Democratic primaries.
Right. And you cite a passage that the phrase from Obama, "I was from everywhere and nowhere at once." I mean, what do you think that says about him as a figure?
I mean, it's extraordinary. If you've read as much of Obama's writing as I have, and I've read all three of his kind of memoir, not sure if there are other. I think that's kind of his whole corpus. He had Dreams from My Father in the 90s, The Audacity of Hope, and then Volume 1, this kind of tombstone of a book. It's only Volume 1 of his memoirs, A Promised Land. And, you notice two things. The first is that, Obama, I don't think, these are not ghost-written books. So this is not, this is not like a John Kerry or Hillary Clinton who pays somebody $1 million or whatever it is to, ghostwrite them a book that they sort of, serve on the writing of in an advisory capacity or something like that. Obama's consciously thought about this, this style. And you notice first that, he's doing that. He's a cut above, he's better at this than, a Hillary Clinton or a John Kerry or the people that, they pay to write their words for them. That's the first thing. The second thing you notice is that he's pretty much doing the same thing over and over again. So there is a kind of middle brow literary flourish that he brings to his writing. He's very dexterous at bringing in lots of different cultural references to music and films and history and all kinds of stuff. But there's a really conscious style that he's employing here and a conscious kind of structure. And it's the same, it's kind of literary version of what his politics are. And it comes through in these, where he's quite explicitly says things like, "Well, I was a platypus who consisted of many parts, many ill-fitting parts." In Dreams from My Father, you can find a passage where he's talking about how he had statues of Buddha at home, and his family would take him to the Shinto shrine and also, the mosque. And, I think it was Matt Taibbi who back in 2007 called Obama an ideological universalist. And that really is consciously what he's trying to do. He's trying to make his autobiography a sort of carte blanche onto which, all of history is kind of, all of history and culture is in some way inscribed, and every political persuasion is inscribed. And that's both what makes him a very compelling figure, but also what makes him, I think, ultimately a pretty conservative figure, because the parts of Obama's book and the kind of parts of his presidency where he was forced, I think, to take kind of clear ideological positions, he always takes the conservative position. That's just what his nature is. And there's a lot of window dressing for what is fundamentally, a view of the world that is not really that distinct from, a Bill or Hillary Clinton or any other number of politicians to come out of this sort of neoliberal tradition.
Except he has, he kind of brands optimism paired with, quote, moral minimalism, as you write. What did you mean by that?
Yeah, so moral minimalism that comes out of a really fantastic piece of writing, an essay Corey Robin published in Dissent, where he read through all the memoirs that had come out of various former Obama staffers. And by moral minimalism, he meant that, there was Obama frequently, he has this kind of grand soaring rhetoric, but if you kind of really nail down the things he talks about, there's a real smallness to them. It's all about, meetings at kitchen tables, these kind of small individual gestures, small individual acts and things like that, those have always been a big part of his kind of rhetorical style. And he's actually very suspicious of kind of, grander morality in politics of the kind you might associate with someone like Bernie Sanders. Right, exactly. Yeah, who makes, you know, whose whole style is premised on very much the opposite of Obama, where he makes these very direct, simple, declarative statements about, you know, healthcare should be a right, not a privilege, you know, et cetera.
Right. I mean, and it just is a very succinct way to describe him. It's also depressing because, as you write, I mean, and I don't want to focus too much on Obama here, but that was your longest section, as you say, and it's really great. I'd really, when it does come out or pre-order it, and I'd encourage everybody to read it. That was like my formative political experience. I don't know about you, but for me, that was, I was one of those, I was a 14-year-old at the time crying when he got elected. I mean, that was really what brought me into and got me invested in politics. And so, I think we're not going to fully be able to grasp what the effects of that are on a generation that was, like with Tony Blair in the late 90s, looking for an alternative to what we saw, especially because the disaster of the Bush administration was even more truncated and because it was within those 8 years as opposed to the long reign of conservatives in the UK, it was even more acute. And there was the economic collapse that immediately followed, but also the two wars that exhausted Americans to a degree.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I think, you know, we have to be careful in introspective in thinking about how our politics are formed. I think that's really important. And because, you know, if the sources of your politics are sort of purely psychological and purely kind of, you know, just situation based in whatever, you know, context you come out of, I think there are limits to that. But there's no getting around the fact that the experience of you know, the millennial generation in particular, on so many things, you know, our experience of the economy, I think, as well. But in terms of in relation to politics, I mean, the experience of people of our generation is, it really is that, you know, we've lived through this kind of teeter-totter of disastrous, I mean, it's kind of a chicken the egg thing. You can begin the story in either place, but let's begin it in the Bush era of this disastrous, incompetent right-wing administration. And then that's replaced by, a liberal administration that people are at least briefly very excited about, which then, you know, fails to deliver on, what a lot of people thought it was going to, helps produce the conditions, quite directly for the next incompetent right-wing administration that's worse, and then, as we saw in 2016 and 2020, works to defeat alternatives to itself, in a way which only lays the groundwork further for, we're in 2022, so I'm thinking about the almost inevitable Trump candidacy in 2024, and so that's the cycle you've lived through. And if that's what your political experience has been, I suppose there are a couple conclusions you could draw from it. I mean, one is that you can become, you can just disengage from politics. And I think that's what a lot of people have done. But another is, you know, particularly if you were raised in a kind of liberalish, milieu, is you can just conclude that liberalism doesn't actually offer the tools. It's not equipped intellectually or politically, to deliver and, forget transformation of the world, even kind of modest egalitarian reform of the world. And so you can look to alternatives. And I think in, the past 5 or 6 years, especially, I guess to an extent as well, after the financial crisis with Occupy Wall Street and things like that, that's what a lot of people have been doing. And that's one of the main reasons why there's been this huge, kind of resurgence, or I'm not even sure if to call it a resurgence, it's just a surgence of kind of interest, in democratic socialism.
Your book also analyzes and writes about some of like the cultural elements that underpin the mid-2000s that I think prime the country for a candidate like Obama, but also was a way of coping through the Bush administration. Things like The Daily Show or the fantasy of the West Wing, Those are liberal. That's liberal fanfic. But that's my surface level analysis. I mean, what did you take from looking at these cultural elements and extrapolating them onto the larger political atmosphere?
Yes. I mean, again, there's no getting around the fact that I was born in the late 1980s. And so, you know, like you, a lot of my, you know, formative cultural kind of artifacts were things, you know, it was the liberalism of the Bush era, right? It was, you know, there's too many things to list, but Jon Stewart and the West Wing were hugely influential on a lot of things at that time. And especially in the case of the latter, I think since as well. So, I mean, there is an essay on Jon Stewart in the book. It's about his movie, I think, that came out in 2020 or 2021, his already forgotten, probably scarcely remembered film, Irresistible, which kind of channels sort of the good intentions of Jon Stewart and also his limitations. You don't need to see the movie, just buy the book and read the essay. When it comes to the West Wing, I mean, I'm a broken record talking about this, but you know, I wrote the essay on the West Wing in 2017. And at the time, I remember thinking that the show, better than anything else, articulated and channeled a certain kind of, you know, liberal view of the world that especially came out during the Obama era. I think I've actually kind of radicalized on that view a little bit. I actually think the West Wing played an active role in shaping that view. And you really see it in the memoirs of people that worked in the Obama White House, where they're all citing this show. I mean, there was a particular type of, you know, Ivy League, you know, 20-year-old or something who in 2007 went to go work for this junior senator from Illinois who was running this really exciting campaign, and their only political education was the West Wing. So, you know, when they get to the White House, they don't think, oh, I'm in the White House, we're running the country now. They think, oh, wow, I'm on the set of my favorite show, you know? And there's so much in the West Wing that you still see manifest in how, you know, liberals view the world, this idea that you can fix everything with a speech, that bipartisanship is not a means to an end, that it's an end in itself. You know, and also just the conservatism of that show is really striking. You know, the fact that this is kind of the liberal fantasy of politics, you know, in the Clinton, Bush and Obama eras. And they don't really pass anything. I mean, I think their most significant legislative achievement is cutting Social Security in an episode where you're supposed to celebrate that. They put a far-right justice on the Supreme Court because in exchange they get a liberal, you know, and the staff of the West Wing find these two, these two lawyers, kind of their banter, they find it charming and they think, wouldn't that be great? You know, there's a subtext to the West Wing that so much of what matters in politics to liberals is just the way they look and the way they make us feel. And so so it's not about ideology really, or that's secondary. It's not about, you know, what a Democratic administration actually achieves or passes, in terms of legislation. It's all about these moments that make us feel good. You know, the West Wing has multiple. It's Obama. It's Obama. It's late night TV, right? It's again, back to Jon Stewart. It's, you know, late night TV and comedians epically owning, Fox News, epically owning the right. And, you know, obviously if you could just defeat the right by owning them with facts and logic, you know, Donald Trump never would have been elected. In the world of the West Wing, Bartlet wins a debate against a Republican governor who's challenging him for the presidency by just shutting him, you know, by shutting him down kind of pedantically in the opening, you know, opening statement. And politics doesn't work that way, obviously.
Yeah. I mean, we could go. I could talk about that for hours, but you.
This is a real rabbit hole. Yeah.
Yeah, and you talk about the Supreme Court justice thing. I mean, that's kind of where we are in terms of Democratic opposition. I mean, they've caught up recently, but to the Supreme Court picks, which brings me to one of your other essays, "Why Liberals Pretend They Have No Power." We'll get people who write into the show or who call in and say, why do you guys, Sam and I, why do we cover Democrats as incompetent or bad at their jobs as opposed to losing on purpose? I think losing on purpose is too conspiratorial and not like accurate, but they are incredibly incompetent, but they're also incentivized, they're feckless by design, and their incentives are all wrong. Curious about your take or what you'd say if you were, you know, here and during the call portion of the show and we got one of those calls.
Yeah, I mean, so I would agree. It depends on what somebody means by they're losing on purpose. I mean, I think there is a sense in which the incentive structures for a lot of kind of senior people, you know, the consultant class that kind of underwrites much of what happens in the Democratic leadership, a lot of the Democratic leaders themselves, right? A lot of these people are exorbitantly rich. Even if, you know, if you lose your seat or whatever in a midterm, you know, there's going to be some, you know, white collar legal firm, some kind of consultancy you can go to, where, you know, you might have a little bit of lost honor because you lost you lost an election to, you know, Yosemite Sam or something, but like, right. you're not going to suffer, you know, the stakes are kind of low for you. So in that sense, I kind of buy the idea that they're, in that sense, you know, maybe Democrats are quote unquote losing on purpose, or at least they're ambivalent about the possibility of losing in some cases. I mean, that essay, you know, kind of dealt with this strange phenomenon of liberals actually in positions of power, kind of acting as if they have no power, which is something you really saw in the Trump era. So I think the occasion for that essay was, Nancy Pelosi calling Donald Trump a third world dictator or something. This was just ahead of the 2020 election, I think. And then, you know, she was asked, well, you know, are you going to shut down the government to stop, you know, some appointment he's going to make or something? And she said, oh no, of course we can't do that. Can't do anything. And that's a theme, a kind of dissonance, if you want, that runs right through the Trump era, where, you know, Democrats were on the one hand, you know, the kind of house rhetoric of liberalism for 4 years. And even before that, during Trump's candidacy, was this is a state of emergency. We're going to have the Fourth Reich in America. This is unlike anything we've ever seen. And then what did Democrats do? Well, they approved a lot of his appointments. They kept the regular functioning of government as it was. You know, you had absurd moments like when Trump's first State of the Union, you know, Van Jones went on TV after and was celebrating, you know, some part of Trump's speech where he addressed a widow in a recent, you know, someone who'd been killed in a recent, you know, raid or something. I mean, just there was just a clear commitment to kind of status quoism and to all of the kind of normal etiquette of American politics, even as, you know, there was all this stuff about how, you know, there was a state of exception. You see the same thing on all kinds of issues, you know, on climate change, where you have, you know, you can have like the governor of California tweet, climate change is real. Someone needs to do something about it. And it's like, yeah, if only there were some executive in charge of the world's fifth largest economy, you know.
But process. I mean, we got to do commit to process or commit to procedure. It's so silly.
Right. And that's related to this, because there is, and again, I hate to keep bringing up the West Wing, but, you know, there is almost a kind of fantasy of impotence here that you see channeled in that show where, and of course there are material reasons for this and ideological reasons as well. But the house style of liberalism today really is, you know, you make these sweeping statements about how bad everything is, how precarious everything is, how dangerous everything is. And then you kind of, at the same time, throw up your hands and you say, well, we can't do anything about it. I mean, you know, we only have 50 seats in the Senate, or we don't have the courts, or Fox News was mean to us. And, you know, so there's a belief that, a belief and almost a celebration, in fact, I think, of these impediments to doing anything, you know, in addition
as
to actually
morally righteous in and of themselves, the impediments are democracy, right? Which is a complete,
that's right.
Yeah, it's very self-serving.
That's right. And I'll just bring up, I don't want to make my answer too long-winded here, but I mean, I'll just bring up one thing that I think is very telling, that is quite exemplary of this, which was something Biden actually said in 2019 when he was running for president, where he said something to the effect of, it's good when you don't have unified party control of the U.S. government. So this is something Biden's saying while he's running for president, to be a Democratic president. You know, he's saying it's good when no party has too much power. So in, you know, the kind of centrist worldview of someone like Biden, the fantasy is that you have to deal with Mitch McConnell. And I think that's really telling. And it's related, you know, it's importantly also not something you see on the right, right? You'd never hear Mitch McConnell or Donald Trump say that.
They'll be the opposition party to oppose the Democrats. And Sam said this, I think, yesterday. Democrats have completely disengaged from being an opposition party. And that's
absolutely.
Yeah. Anyway, Luke Savage, writer for Jacobin Magazine, author of The Dead Center, Reflections on Liberalism and Democracy After the End of History. You can pre-order it now. Luke, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Emma. Pleasure.
Of course. All right, we are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we are going to be joined by congressional candidate running in New York's 12th district, Rana Abdelhamid. We'll be right back. We are back, and we are joined by Rana Abdelhamid, congressional candidate running in New York's 12th district. Rana, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm really grateful to be in
conversation. Well, I'm excited to talk to you. You are a Justice Democrat. You're a progressive running to challenge Carolyn Maloney here right in our backyard in a district that both encompasses the western part of Queens, but the Upper East Side. And, you know, it's not hard to guess where Carolyn Maloney lives.
Right, exactly. It is. It's really a tale of two districts. It's one of the most unequal districts in the country, one of the most unequal places in the world.
Right. And there are other parts of New York, parts of Brooklyn, Greenpoint that are in this district. But, you know, it's one of those bizarrely drawn districts. But I mean, that also makes for a campaign. I don't know. I'm curious how you're approaching it. You have to appeal to a bunch of different people. It seems, though, like Maloney has trended more towards representing the wealthier interests in the city and in the district. And your approach has been a bit different.
Yeah, absolutely. So I actually was born and raised in Queens. I'm from this district, raised in this district. Representative Maloney obviously has been in office for close to 3 decades now, and her focus has really been on certain parts of this district for so long, and she has not engaged with the parts of Queens, parts of Brooklyn, and parts of Manhattan that have not been her natural base and the wealthiest parts of the district. In fact, with the new lines that were drawn, she was actually quite public in stating that she didn't want any part of Queens or any part of Brooklyn in her district, which is, you know, quite hard to hear your own representative say that she doesn't want to represent you anymore. And then actually see like parts of Queens and parts of Brooklyn being cut out. And so much of this race has been about making sure that the communities that have not been centered in our electoral process are finally feeling like they're being heard and feeling like we're able to build political power in collective.
So you grew up in Astoria, you grew up in Queens. I mean, right now, Astoria, Western Queens in particular, is a ground zero for gentrification in the city. I mean, I'm here in Brooklyn, so I know it intimately, and in terms of just these high rises being built all around us. I mean, what would you do as representative to combat that? And I guess maybe we could start first with your personal experience with that kind of gentrification.
Yeah, and so it's really heartbreaking because when people think of Astoria in the context of like housing justice or movement work, it's always like Astoria's gone. Like, you know, people almost give up on it because gentrification has been happening for a really long time. I mean, my family, rising rent costs impacted our housing situation maybe like 15 years ago when I was just a teenager. We were pushed out of our home. My family ran a small business here in Astoria, off of Broadway in Queens. And, you know, I really saw my parents struggle to keep our small business alive. And eventually, because of rising rent costs, we lost our small business and lost our livelihood, right? And it was a very difficult time. And even just it being in Astoria, walking around, so much of it has changed. West Queens, so much of it has changed because of the luxury developments that are constantly going up, despite the incredible organizing that has been happening. And so for me, coming to this race is so much about an understanding that we need systemic change to fight for housing justice across the city. West Queens is also home to the largest public housing unit in all of North America. And when people think about New York 12, you know, people do not think about the fact that we are home to Queensbridge. And so we are running on a housing justice platform, and we're centering this reality of gentrification, lack of funding for public housing, as a key part of our platform.
Yeah, I'm hoping you can expand on that a little bit because, Eric Adams just broke up a houseless encampment and then went to, you know, then he went to that party. I mean, might have not been on the same day. I'm hung up on that because it's such a stark contrast.
Yeah, I saw that too. I was like,
Yeah, right. It's just a credit card party. We have not in this country emphasize public housing from a federal level. It's been decades, I believe, since there's been any funding, but even here in the city, as a way to not just combat houselessness, but make sure that gentrification is not the problem that it is. What would you do as the representative of New York 14 to make sure that public housing is not only maintained, but that it's increase in its presence here in the city?
Yeah, you know, as a representative for New York District 12, what's really important is to see exactly what you're saying, the model for public housing as a permanent solution for the lack of affordability in the city. We know that close to 50% of renters across the city are rent burdened. We know that when we leave it up to the market in general, right, to build housing, oftentimes that housing solution looks like the luxury development that we're seeing. What we need at a federal level is we need a national rent control. So we're increasing the number of units that are rent controlled in the city. What we need is we need to fully fund our public housing so people aren't having to live with mold or having to live in cold in the middle of the winter in cold because there isn't a proper heating system in their building, or having to deal with the reality of climate crisis in their buildings because of lack of proper infrastructure. And we need to expand the number of public housing that exists in the city. There's real opportunity for us to do this. We know that there are so many vacant units across the city that are not being used, and the very dehumanizing, criminalizing approaches that current Mayor Adams is leveraging to actually address some of these challenges while he's simultaneously proposing a budget that defunds homelessness services by $600 million shows that we aren't really caring to address this cause and address these issues at its root cause of the issue, but rather just, you know, trying to put a Band-Aid solution over it to kind of push it under the rug.
I mean, I feel like there is a certain section of wealthy people in the city that would just rather not see certain people. They just rather them not be out of sight, out of mind, as opposed to actually dealing with the problem. Your platform's very progressive, Green New Deal, Medicare for All. I mean, what motivated you to run, and how do you identify yourself as a progressive, as a democratic socialist? I mean, would you be a part of the squad if you were elected to Congress? I mean, how do you perceive your candidacy as it fits into like this larger leftist surge of candidates that we've seen over the past few years?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I always say, you know, is I'm a community organizer. I'm a movement person. I come from organizing in New York City since I was a public high school student. Like, that has always been my focus. I'm a self-defense instructor. I'm a healing justice facilitator. I came to this work as a working class person. I came to this work as a survivor of a hate-based attack, as a Muslim woman. And what I'm going to be focused on in my tenure as a representative, as someone who's organizing electorally, is making sure that my North Star is always the communities that are organizing across New York City that have been left behind by electoral politics, working class families, people of color, public housing tenants, Section 8 tenants, and progressive people across the district who really care to make New York City a place where everyone can survive and everyone can thrive, because that's not the city that we exist in right now.
Right. And you mentioned your activism there. You have a nonprofit that's worked in the gender violence space. Can you talk a little bit about your work in that area and how that that made you who you were today, your candidacy, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. So I, I am a survivor of a hate-based attack. I started a nonprofit that's focused on building safety and power for women and non-binary people across the country and across the globe. We do self-defense training. We do healing justice training. And doing that work really showed me so many things. I mean, when people talk about the shelter system, that work has always reminds me of the reality that our shelter system is so overwhelmed, right? That in the middle of the pandemic, people who are survivors of domestic violence and gender-based violence were having to isolate with their abusers because they had no other option. They had no other place to go because of the reality of our housing crisis in this city. And so that, in so many ways, that work has shown me that our communities have the power to keep ourselves safe, that if we invest in civil society and organizations, if we invest in trauma-informed response, and if we invest in proper anti-racism education, our communities will be safe. And if we actually address these issues from an anti-poverty lens and a lens that is empathetic and humane, that we would really have a city that could thrive. And so that is a lot of what the work has shown me.
And lastly, I was hoping you could touch a little bit on teachers unions in general, but nationally we're seeing such an attack on education. It's a twofer for Republicans. They get to attack gay people and trans people. And at the same time, they can undercut teachers by basically threatening them. If you decide to teach about the gay agenda in classrooms, you could be ousted. But particular to New York City, I'm from Jersey too. Like, there were a lot of charter schools, and there was a lot of democratic undercutting of teachers' unions. I mean, there's the bigoted, insane ways the right does it, but there are ways that Democrats who, under the guise of school choice, have undercut both public education and teachers as well. How would you approach that as a representative in regards to charter schools and also supporting teachers' unions as well?
Yeah, I'm a huge supporter of New York City public schools, as someone who is a graduate of New York City public schools, as someone who had the opportunity to conduct self-defense and safety programming over the past couple of years in New York City public schools. And I know that, you know, New York City public schools are also severely segregated. There's a lack of funding. We need to expand Title I funding. We need to make sure that teachers have the resources that they need. And we need to move away from this system that is so overwhelmingly reliant on standardized testing, right? And makes it so difficult for teachers to actually do their jobs. And also the reality is right now, especially within the context of the pandemic, within the context of this current political climate, so many students and so many teachers are severely overwhelmed from a mental health perspective. And we need to invest in counselors. We need to divest from the school to prison pipeline. And these are all things that I would stand for at a federal level to make our schools more effective for students across the city, not just for some students who have access to things like charter schools or alternative programming to public schools, but rather really invest in our public school system.
Well, that's great. Where can people learn more about your campaign and help out in any way?
Yeah, so we're a 100% grassroots funded, grassroots powered campaign. If you're able to contribute and support, volunteer with our race, like, definitely feel free to reach out at www.rana4congress.com, and we'd really appreciate your support in whatever way possible.
Awesome. We're gonna just put this on the screen here. This is your website. the Act Blue link here. We'll just pop this up right here. Yes. So people have a visual understanding where they can go. Rana, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate your time today. Rana Abdelhamid, congressional candidate running in New York's 12th district. And the primary's in June, right?
Yes, June 28th.
June 28th. All right, check it out. Thanks so much, Rana.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks. With that, we are going to head into the fun half. But first, Left Reckoning. It's already happened this week. How'd it go?
Yeah, it went really well. We had a Wozni Lambre, my buddy, and basketball podcaster at the Ringer on for his second Left Reckoning appearance. The first time we talked about the original formation of the NBA Players Union and a lot of the stuff we think of as like new social justice stuff that players are doing, actually not quite so new, come to find. And last night we talked about the current era of player empowerment, sort of where NBA players are deciding that they aren't as constrained by taking whatever deals that they can and are willing to say, like LeBron, go to Miami for less money to play with better players.
Yeah.
And what that actually means for the NBA capitalists who need to control their workers a little bit. So if you want to get a little bit of access or insight into a conversation about how exploitation works for even highly, highly paid workers, last night, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We also got deep into the Starbucks and Amazon stuff. So you can listen to that too.
I'm reminded of that Scottie Pippen contract that was so exploitative because he came from such little money and they essentially signed him for on the low for like 10 years and wouldn't let him out of it. I mean, those days are a bit over in the NBA, but it's still an uphill battle.
Yeah, all the systems are just like reformed versions of those originally highly exploitative things. Like the original, I can't remember who the first basketball player was that got the exception that they didn't have to do 4 years of college basketball, but it was for that. It was a basketball player whose parents were, or mother at least, was like a literal sharecropper. And it's like, yeah, we can let this guy go earn some money professionally rather than, you know, playing for free for some academic institution. And you know, like it's better now. You don't have to go to 4 years of college, but there's still
In the NFL, you have to go to three.
Right, exactly. And that's all, it's the same thing. It's all sort of labor protection. Right?
And in the NFL, like in the NBA, when someone signs a $72 million contract, they're getting $72 million. In the NFL, it's even worse because like it's all hidden. It's only the guaranteed money. And even if you have like a 5-year contract, it's really only two or three.
Yeah.
And it's just the guaranteed money.
I did not know, though, that second round draft picks in the NBA, that those contracts are not guaranteed.
Right.
I found out last night. So, yeah.
Yeah, I know that in the context of our boy Mitchell Robinson, Bradley. But anyway, that sounds awesome. Let's bring in, we're still waiting for Binder, but we got, all right, let's bring in Brandon. Brandon, hello.
Hello, Emma. How's it going?
It's going all right. What's happening over on the discourse?
We put out an episode on the Patreon last week regarding the Ukraine situation update, and we'll be recording again this weekend. So ideally, we'll have another one out this Monday. But yeah, I don't know what we're going to be talking about yet because the news hasn't happened yet.
Right. That's typically how it goes. All right. Well, definitely check out Doomed. Check out Scam Economy.
Yes. Scams are prolific now. I mean, or they prodigious. Are.
I mean, it's both. Coming to Starbucks to help, you know, protect that. Like, hey, you know you want a union, but what if got a nice little lazy ape here?
I think Star Trek is getting into NFTs, too. They're doing, like, their own little NFT promotional material.
I was really happy.
I hear Binder now. We have Binder. Well, now we don't need to just promote his show. He can do it for himself. There he is.
Mm-hmm.
We were saying, no, I was going to make a snarky comment. Go ahead.
It was too, but I'm still going to do it. I was going to say, in a time of scams, we need you now more than ever.
Oh, why thank you. Well, tonight, 9 p.m. on Scam Economy, youtube.com/MattBinder, and it'll be up on Apple Podcasts, etc., scameconomy.com. I will be talking with Liana First Arai, who is a climate and environmental journalist. And we basically break down. You might have seen this recent report about how Bitcoin is actually going to save us all because Exxon is selling gas that basically leaks out into the atmosphere to Bitcoin mining operations. And the claim from the Bitcoin communities are, oh, this is great. They're going green, solving the issue. Well, not quite. And you'll find out all about gas flaring. It's a very educational episode tonight, at 9 p.m. scameconomy.com, youtube.com/MattBinder. And also on Doomed on Tuesday night, and it's via podcast too at doomedcast.com. I spoke with, Dr. Eric, Osgood. He is a doctor who I previously had on, who, talked with me about ivermectin previously when this was all going, when everyone was going crazy for ivermectin on the right. People were taking horse paste. And there was basically this new, study that came out that once and for all pretty much concluded that, ivermectin, not a treatment for COVID-19. And, he came on to discuss that and with the details about that and how, people on the right and anti-vaxxers are still trying to push it. It was an interesting episode. Doomcast.com, youtube.com/MattBinder.
Awesome. All right.
And Eric's a good source on that. I mean, we had him on TMBS back before the vaccines were out, I hasten to add. And he was a doctor who thought that there might be some plausibility to ivermectin as a solution. Now, I hasten to add again that we were talked about this on TMBS before there was vaccines that, it would preclude for people taking, and not as an alternative vaccines, but as like maybe something doctors should look into as a possible avenue. And he did look into it. And it turns out that, like Binder said, it was false promise.
Yep.
Right. Yeah, it's really him being out there telling people about this, about ivermectin not working, is super important because he was affiliated with that group who in the beginning was just like a bunch of frontline COVID-19 doctors trying out whatever was possible and within reason before there was a vaccine. And then they went a complete fringe route and he cut ties with them. So, his voice behind this is really important because he has that sort of in there to let us know, how far off these doctors who are pushing this stuff went.
All right. We are going to head into the fun half. The phone number is 646-257-3920. See you there.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
You.
What is up, everyone?
Nomi Keen.
You did it.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this,
7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is it me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go start
off. Libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$5.43 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all, my favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
folks.
It's just the wheat being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sundial guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow.
Folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.